All right, Isaiah chapter 14, if you would. This text this morning contains, and you probably already caught it, one of the most familiar passages of the Old Testament, perhaps even of the entire Bible. I cannot imagine how many messages, if you collectively put us all together, we have all heard from that one memorable paragraph. But I can't imagine this, that most of those messages you have heard from that memorable paragraph have focused on the pride of the character Lucifer because of those infamous I wills, the five I wills. I've done it. How many other pastors have done it? I'm sure Tom's done it. I'm sure Ross has done it. I'm sure Nat and Bill maybe even have focused on the five I wills of Lucifer. But, you know, there's more there than just that. That's two verses. There's much more there. And I think that this morning the Lord would have us glean a few additional things from the chapter. Begins with victory and success. There's a song. They sing a new song in there, verse 7. It's all the result of the second coming of Jesus Christ. He comes as the Messiah. So it begins with victory and success. Look at verses 1 and 2 for me. The Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel. He'll set them in their own land, and the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. The strangers shall cleave. And the people, the house of Jacob, Israel, shall take them and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel shall possess the strangers in the land of the Lord, and they'll be servants and handmaids, and they shall take them captives whose captives they were, and they shall rule over their oppressors. You know, after all the ugliness of chapter 13 that we looked at last time, this text, this message from the prophet will mark a startling change. And the only reason for that change is the coming of Jesus Christ, their Messiah. Only reason. Israel is not the church. And Israel is not looking for a rapture for its salvation. That doesn't apply to Israel. This is the importance of seeing prophetic passages in their context and dispensationally. The only true deliverance for Israel will be in the destruction and annihilation of her enemies by the arrival of the righteous judge, their Messiah. That's the only salvation Israel will experience. And it is no wonder, something to think about, something to talk to each other about when you ride home. Israel prays for deliverance from her oppressors, while the church ought to be praying for God's mercy on the oppressors and sharing the gospel with them. Think about that one. Verse 1, the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and yet choose Israel. Jacob means all of Israel when it is used in this sense. And then it's specified with the very next phrase. It includes Israel by name. Strangers is the old Hebrew word meaning sojourners. It's like having long-term guests. You know, the people that, you know, you wish wouldn't stay. Family, usually. Aren't they going home soon? That kind of thing. They will be in their own land, and these guests will actually cleave to the Israelites. Cleave means more than just guests or sojourners simply living in the land. Cleave indicates that they will attach themselves to the Israelites like glue. They're going to get stuck right on them. They're going to say, look, I'll be your servant, but I need to stay close to you. Now tell me, have we ever seen anything like that in world history at all, ever? You know how many nations have tried to purge the Jews from their population? I mean, this goes back 500, 600, 700 years. Today, In Israel, there are many non-Jews living there. Of a population of 9.2 million people, about 75% are actually Jewish, and 21% are Arab slash Muslim slash Palestinian slash Druze, and then 4% are some other nationalities. Do you know that in Israel today, Arabs can run and hold office in the Knesset, and they have their own political party? They're not cleaving to Jews like our text says they will in the future. That's a future day. We're looking at something that hasn't happened yet. It's the day of the Lord. Look at verse 2. People shall take them, bring them to their place. The house of Israel shall possess them in the land of the Lord for servants and handmaids. They shall take them captives whose captives they were. Take has the idea of, I need a prop, seizing something. I can walk over here and pick up the tissue box, or I can walk over here and seize the tissue box. That's the difference. That's what that word means, seizing. Captive means captive. That one's not special. But it gets even better. They shall rule over their oppressors. What a turn of events. What a change. What a difference. This is something only the Lord can accomplish. This is role reversal at its very best, and only God can reverse those roles. So consider for a minute, this is the second coming of Jesus to earth. He comes as the conquering Messiah. He saves Israel. This is the culmination. We know our prophecy. We studied it, a year and a half or two ago now. We studied prophecy. This is the culmination of the seven-year tribulation. So, just how many Israelites do you think are still in the land after 7 years of tribulation? How many are still alive? When Moses led the people out of Israel, estimates range anywhere from 1 million to 2 million people. It was a mixed multitude. So let's say 1.5 million were actually Jews and 500,000 were Egyptians or something else. When Ezra records after the end of the 70-year Babylonian captivity, he is exceedingly specific. You go to Ezra, I think it's chapter 4. You go to Ezra and you add them up and you come up to 49,897 returnees from Babylon back to Egypt. Or back to Israel, sorry. Egypt on the brain, I guess. So we can only make an educated guess as to how many were still back in Babylon. And they're in Babylon. That's the event surrounding the book of Esther. Esther and Mordecai and all the Jews that were there in that kingdom are ones who did not return with Ezra and Nehemiah. That's what that book is all about. So our educated guess, after Nebuchadnezzar came to Judea and made three deportations of Israeli citizens, he took them all back to his kingdom. And they were there for 70 years. So maybe an estimate might be, it's an educated guess, 500,000 people. And 50,000, the remnant returned with Ezra and Nehemiah. So how many people are still going to be alive at the end of the tribulation in Israel? Not very many, I would recommend. There's a word right there I just used. Remnant. God always works through a remnant. He doesn't need millions to accomplish his work because he gets greater glory when he uses fewer people. You remember some fella named Gideon? No, that's too many. No, that's still too many. Oh, we whittled it down to 300. Do not underestimate God's ability to get things done. Look at the size, look not at the size of the nation or the size of the church. Look at the size of God. Look at what God does here in Isaiah, verse 3. He's going to give Israel rest. It shall come to pass in the day that the Lord shall give thee rest. Rest from what? Rest from sorrow, rest from fear, rest from bondage in slavery to others. So whether it was Assyria or Babylon or Tyre or any other nation that persecutes Israel, in fact, the truth is whether it's all the nations, because in that setting at the end of the tribulation, all the nations will be against Israel. He's going to give them rest. Look at verse 4. That thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased. The Lord hath broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he that ruled the nations in anger is persecuted and nobody can stop him. Now, there's an expression here, or an expansion would be a better word, you know what I mean, beyond the literal Babylons. He that ruleth the nations. So this is an individual who rules more than Babylon. It includes more than Israel. And when you say, when the Bible uses that expression, the nations, it means the whole world. So what we have is another judgment of the king of Babylon, but which king? We've moved from literal Babylon to a bigger picture. That's what prophetic writing does. Verse 7 says, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. We've moved from just the land of Israel, the promised land, to the whole earth being at rest. Tell me, when has the whole earth ever been at rest? In recorded history, some scholar wrote many years ago, there's only been about 70 years of recorded history where someone hasn't been fighting someone somewhere. The whole earth is at rest. It is quiet. They break forth into singing. Yea, the fir trees rejoice at thee, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you are gone, you are laid down, you're dead, no feller has come up against us. Hell from beneath is moved for thee to meet thee at thy coming. It stirs up the dead for thee, even all the chief ones of the earth. Those are already dead. This scene is in hell. It hath raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. They're not on thrones. They're still kings in hell. They're not ruling over anything, but it doesn't mean they're all of a sudden aren't king anymore. They shall speak and say, are you come also weak like we are? Art thou become like we are, like unto us? Thy pomp is brought, that's an interesting word, thy pomp is brought down to the grave, and the noise of thy musical instruments, viols, the worm is spread under thee and the worms cover thee. It is quite apparent at this point that this is no ordinary king of Babylon. This king affected the whole earth. Babylon's kings, none of them, not even Nebuchadnezzar, affected the whole earth. And now that he is gone, this person, the whole earth is at rest. In hell, all the deceased mighty ones of the earth, from the very many nations, rise up to meet this king. Now, we are a pretty well-studied church family. Who might this sound like, this king of Babylon? Remember, Isaiah uses the king of Babylon in a symbolic way to represent the world system that is allied against God and God's chosen people, Israel. This is that world leader empowered by Satan himself, who the Bible calls Antichrist. He will be the leader of a world system trying to destroy Israel when the Messiah comes and saves Israel. Look at verse 5 and 6 one more time. The Lord hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. He, the Antichrist, who smote the people in wrath with a continual stroke. He that ruled the nations in anger is persecuted and none hinders. The Lord will come He will put an end to Antichrist's reign over the nations. And now Isaiah writes about the real power behind that individual, Lucifer. Now we're at verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven? You see, now we understand that this paragraph doesn't just jump in here. It's part of what Isaiah is writing. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? He weakened them, not the ground. For thou hast said in thine heart, and we know the five I wills, yet, verse 15, thou shalt be brought down to hell to the sides of the pit. This well-known passage is so often pulled from that overall context, but we need to take a look at what the Lord is really saying here, all of it. Isaiah wants us to see that the source of sin is in the demise of the originator of sin. His name is Lucifer. And this is the only occurrence of that word, that name, in the entire Bible. And the name means light bearer, or shining one, morning star, day star. Transliteration is Lucifer. And we can't understand this passage in its entirety without looking at the other major passage that deals with this person. If you know your Bible, you know where you're going to go. Put your finger in Isaiah and turn to Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28. In similar fashion to Isaiah, Ezekiel begins addressing a literal person, the king of Tyre. Ezekiel 28, 1 and 2. The word of the Lord came again unto me, unto Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, Thus saith the Lord God, because thine heart is lifted up, and thou hast said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God, in the midst of the seas, yet thou art a man. So, this is not Lucifer or Satan, right? He's a man. He starts out speaking to a man, the king of Tyrus. And not God, though thou set thine heart as God, the literal king of Tyre. And then, like Isaiah does, this king becomes symbolic of a far greater individual. Look down at verse 11, because we can't take the time to read all of this. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation against the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord. There's your formula, for this is the word of God. Thou sealest up the sum. So here's God's message. Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Do you see? We've moved from a literal king now. Because the king of Tyrus had never been in Eden. We've now moved. This is what prophetic writing does. Every precious stone was thy covering. The sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. Nothing there applies to a real human except the fact that God created him. That's it. That's the only thing. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in thee. By the multitude of thy merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and you have sinned. Therefore I will cast thee as a profane out of the mountain of God. I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted by wisdom, thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings. Does that sound like Isaiah? Oh, you bet it does. When hell welcomed him, I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings that they may behold thee. Okay, obviously, and I've made the point already, the text is no longer speaking about the literal king of Tyre. This is Lucifer. The description of this created being certainly fits the meaning of the name Lucifer. Bright, shining, morning star. You need to realize that the book of Isaiah deals with two major leaders, both in a symbolic way. F.C. Jennings wrote this, and I hope it helps. Tyre was the representative exponent of commerce, as Babylon was of the religion of the world. Tyre represents the material side of this fallen one's activity, ever desiring to possess the earth. Babylon, the spiritual, that would aim at heaven. And as in those primal days when rebellious man would both build both a city and a tower, and that comes from Genesis, Tyre would correspond to the city that was to cover the earth, and Babylon with the tower that was to reach to heaven. See the symbolism? This is why so many people get prophecy wrong, and it's why it's so difficult. Now, point of all this doesn't involve the church. Doesn't matter to me and you. We're not going to be there. Well, we'll be with the Lord, but we're not Jews. We're not Israel. The rapture will have occurred 7, maybe 8 years earlier, 9, who knows? But a difficult struggle ought to arise in your heart. One that countless people have struggled with. The main thing that we need to get from a passage like this one, and this one in particular, is not Lucifer one of God's created angelic beings? Yeah, text is pretty clear, isn't it? Well, if God is good, and he only made good things, and there's no evil in him, how did he create Lucifer, the morning star, or the day star? How'd that happen? Does evil ever come from good? No. Can the sun give out darkness? The sun only gives out light. It gets nighttime, but that's not because the sun went off. This is simply another way in this text of stating what philosophers and Christian apologists have struggled with. I can't tell you how long. The problem of evil. In our text in Isaiah, the questions become a little more refined. If God is the source of all that is good and God created Lucifer, is God then also the source of evil? No, he's not. So before we look at the Bible for our answer, because that's where we're going to get the answer, I want to make the point that this is not merely an academic exercise this morning. There's a practical purpose for us looking at what we're going to look at. We need to be able to examine and answer that very serious question. If I took a survey this morning of you all, I would guess that nearly every one of us has faced that question in some way, shape, or form before. Some examples. If your God is so good, why is there all this hate in the world? Anybody heard that? If your God is so powerful, why doesn't he just wipe out all the wicked people? Why doesn't he just stop natural disasters? If God is all-knowing, why did he allow Lucifer to sin to deceive Adam and Eve? Why are there floods and tidal waves and hurricanes and earthquakes and all manner of natural disasters that kill innocent little people and babies and all the whole nine yards? Why is God allowing abortion to continue? We got to be prepared to answer and be able to answer those kinds of questions. Or quite honestly, we lose all credibility with people who don't believe in God or don't care about God or don't want to hear the gospel message. My Hebrew professor used to say, and I've used this before, we live in a day and an age where it is no longer sufficient to say, well, because the Bible said so. That doesn't work anymore. Well, such and such is so because the Bible said it is. You know what the response will be? Why? Or, so what? Or who says? Got to be able to prove. And you can. I'm so tired of people saying, well, I can't prove that from the Bible. Yes, you can. If the Bible is all we need for faith and practice, if it is our only source of information, then it's fully prepared to help us answer the questions we are posed, that are posed to us. The Bible says, and we just read it in Ezekiel, that Lucifer was, quote, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. And then we read that amazing description of the highest of all the spiritual beings that God created. The pinnacle of his heavenly host was this spirit being named Lucifer. And we read this. That's why I took the time to read the description from Ezekiel. He was quite the character. He was quite the angelic being. Ezekiel says in verse 15, thou was perfect, complete in thy ways from the day thou was created till iniquity was found in thee. And in that created state, now listen carefully, innocent but not holy, that is intrinsically holy like God, Lucifer had the free will to walk in any direction he chose, physically, morally, spiritually. Even as Ezekiel said, I have set thee so, thou wast upon the holy mountain of God, you have walked up and down in the midst of the stones. Lucifer had freedom of action, agency, thinking. The bright and morning star was not created as Satan or the devil or the old serpent. He was the capstone of God's spiritual creations, of the heavenly host. The text is clear. God created Lucifer without sin. It is wrong to trace the source of sin back to the source of all that is good, back to God. God did a really good job creating Lucifer. In fact, God not only did a really good job, he did a perfect job, a complete job. The true source of sin and all of its consequences is the character that we now know as Satan, the devil, the old serpent. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8, he that committeth sin is of God? No, he's of the devil. Why? For the devil sinneth from the beginning. For this purpose, the Son of Man was manifest, that he might destroy the works of the devil. So from the beginning here in 1 John 3:8 means from the beginning of sin, not from the beginning of creation. Because Ezekiel indicates clearly that Lucifer walked in innocence until he sinned. Lucifer is the source of sin. Lucifer is the originator of sin. Lucifer is the first sinner. The text says it. You sinned. Isaiah describes that sin in our text. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Freedom of action or freedom of the will to act is the loftiest attribute of the highest of God's spiritual creations. Every one of us in this room has freedom of thought and freedom of actions. I don't care if you live in North Korea or Communist China, they have freedom of thought. How many have read 1984, George Orwell, right? You could still think. But don't mouth the words or the TV would see you. You could still think. That liberty necessarily predicated the possibility of that freedom rising in opposition even to the Creator. That is sin. The wages of sin is death. Physical death eventually for Adam and Eve because they have physical bodies. Spiritual death immediately. Lucifer, now we call him Satan, as a spiritual being did not die physically, never can, never could, never will. But spiritual death, biblically speaking, is separation from God. And this will be his eternal spiritual death. When in God's timing, that sentence is carried out. Revelation chapter 20, verse 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. That will be Satan's eternal spiritual death. You do realize Satan has access to God. He stands before him accusing us, the brethren, right now. He will never have that again. But God. I love those two words. Those amazing words. But God sent his only begotten Son. And what about his Son? Because we still have a question or two to answer. We all understand Jesus could not sin. Intrinsically, he was intrinsically holy. That would be a violation of that intrinsic holiness. He is God. Does that make Jesus somehow less than Lucifer? Lucifer had freedom of choice, but Jesus does not? You're going to get asked that question. God forbid, as Paul said. What we have here is a biblical paradox. Gotta love a good paradox. Jesus, the Son of God, unable to sin, impeccable, by no means lacked freedom of choice. But he could only walk in a path that was not relative, but absolutely good. That's indeed a mystery. It is a mystery fitting of God calling his only begotten Son. No man knoweth the Son but the Father, neither knoweth any man the Father save the Son. Matthew 11. In the Son, there has always been and there will always be freedom of choice. Even though, paradoxical as it seems, he cannot violate his holiness by choosing an evil action or an evil attitude. That's the difference between innocence and holiness. Innocence has not done but can do. Holiness cannot do. Innocence has not done but can do. Holiness cannot do. Holiness cannot do any more than a sheep can willingly roll in the filth of the mud of the pigsty, even though he has the freedom to do it. We ride by the pigs on whatever road that is. Hampton Road that we come across, one of those roads. Friedberg Church Road. The pigs along that, they love the mud. Sheep would not go near it, but they can. Biblical paradoxes are wonderful things, but they're difficult at the same time. That's a paradox in itself, no pun intended. How do we handle them then? You know the answer. Five-letter word starts with faith. We accept Jesus Christ by faith, don't we? We trust the things we cannot explain in the Bible by faith. What caused Satan to sin? Yeah, I know. We got the five I wills. There are whole messages on that. Certainly, though, it did not come from God. He is only light and only good and only holiness. It could not come from anything external to Satan because everything God made was good. There was nothing external of him. It had to come from inside. Ezekiel says, "Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness." Lucifer's sin came from within. Self-born sin, we might say. Satan looked at himself, pride reared its ugly head, and off he went. Christian, guard your heart. Satan's a spiritual being. He doesn't have a heart. The text says, in his heart. We know what that means. Heart is a word that is used to indicate the center of one's being, the thought centers of your mind. We use mind today. Remember 1 John 3:8. He that committeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sinneth from the beginning. But for this purpose, the Son of God was manifested that he might destroy the works of the devil. God sent his only begotten Son, another one with a capital O this time, who is more properly called the bright morning star. It's not an accident that God only put the word Lucifer in the text one time. One time. Revelation 22:16. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify unto you, John, these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. Wow. That's the star I want. Not that counterfeit. Not that sinner. Not that one who tempted Adam and Eve. May he rest in hell eternally. Guard your heart. Out of it are the issues of life. We're all susceptible to the siren call of pride. We all struggle with the application of true Christian Christ-like humility. We all do it. But the preventative to prideful thoughts or attitudes is to focus on the bright morning star. Let me finish with one quote from Jennings. Complacent self-occupation, even with what God may work in us. Do you know what he's saying? Complacent self, in other words, you let your guard down, you become complacent. Self-occupation, even if you're doing God's work, is filled with great danger. And only with occupation in our thoughts with Jesus himself, his perfections, his beauty, his love, only there lies our safety, joy, and blessing. Yes, our true holiness.